Shares. Market.
The S&P.
The ASX.
Stocks.
This is Motley Fool Money.
Welcome to Motley Fool Money, the podcast that is here, even though it's a short week. We couldn't leave you without a special edition of Motley Fool Money. Well, it's kind of special just because every edition is special, really, isn't it, Doc?
It is. Very special.
Another special edition.
Another special.
I'm Scott Phillips, and as you've heard, I'm with Dr. Anirban Mahanty. Mate, you've just come back from a week or so in the land of the long white cloud.
Yeah, just 5 days.
How was it?
It was great.
Yeah?
Queenstown. Beautiful.
Nice. Is it too early for snow?
Yeah, there's no snow there.
No snow. But, right. Yeah, what was the best part of your holiday, mate? Get out of the way.
I don't know, driving around, having some free time. I really like driving around New Zealand, actually, and the South Island part. Really good.
Very nice, mate. Very nice. Glad you enjoyed it. We will just pause for a second to recognise that yesterday was Anzac Day, of course, and we do pay our respects to the veterans, both returned and those who didn't. We appreciate their sacrifice and their service of our country. Doc, we will get on with this week's podcast, though. Firstly, we're going to talk about Macquarie, doing something a little bit un-Macquarie. So let's stand by for that one. Another trillion-dollar US company. It seems like we're minting them by the month these days. Another company missed or hit the trillion-dollar mark, I should say. Jeez, get my teeth back in. Warren Buffett is kind of not sure whether you should buy Berkshire Hathaway anymore. I read that very carefully this morning because I'm a Berkshire Hathaway shareholder, as you and our listeners know, Doc. And we will, of course, do one of our favorite things and one of yours. Dip into the Fool Mailbag. Let's get it underway.
Let's do it.
Motley Fool Money. Financial advice for real people, not trust fund hippies. Sign up for the newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM.
Macquarie, the millionaire's factory, the silver donut. Not really a name you associate. Well, funnily enough, you do, but let's get to that in a second. The bank itself, not really exactly a mobile telephony name you would think of, right? There's Telstra and there's Optus and there's Vodafone and there's Amaysim and there's plenty of others. But
you're forgetting TPG.
Well, TPG, of course. Yeah, I'm thinking about mobile here, though. TPG's not really a mobile provider just yet.
Just yet, yeah.
There is Macquarie Telecom, but this is not the same thing. Macquarie Telecom, same name, different business. But the Silver Donut, the Millionaire's Factory, wants to be a mobile telephony provider. Are we going to see kind of Macquarie take on the likes of Telstra and Optus for kind of supremacy in the mobile wars?
I don't know. This is a funny one because, you
Isn't
know, I would have never expected that to happen.
I know. Really
strange,
right?
This is really strange. Well, it looks like they are going to be what they call a mobile virtual network operator, which basically means that you're going to be a mobile operator without owning the network. So you're going to essentially own.
That sounds made up to me. Tell me how that works.
So basically, you basically are think of it as like a white labeled version of a Telstra mobile.
Okay.
So they're going to be running on the Telstra network.
Okay. So the likes of the Kogans and the Woolworths and the others who basically pay either Telstra or Optus for access to their towers
and
run a kind of a branded version of a Telstra network.
Exactly. Yeah. Although what I read is that they're trying to do something else. They're trying to actually do used cell phones,
right? And that's why this is fascinating, right?
It's so fascinating.
You can't actually join the network without buying one of their phones.
Yeah, so you have to, and it's a used phone,
right? Right,
which I thought weird.
Now, so here's the thing: I didn't know till I read the article. Macquarie own a million used mobile phones because they're the guys who are basically providing the financing for the kind of lease operations of Telstra and others. So that when the lease ends, you've got to give the phone back. And it seems like Macquarie's got a warehouse full of phones and they've kind of gone, guys, what are we doing with these phones? And some bright spark's gone, well, I guess we better start a mobile network.
So, yeah. So they're going to sell those used phones that they get back with a SIM on them. I don't know. I think, you know, it's an interesting strategy. Probably, you know, they've probably written off most of the value of the handset.
Fine, yes.
Right. So
squeezing one last bit of juice out of the lemon.
Yeah, squeezing that one last little bit of juice out of the lemon.
Yes, fair enough, right? If it's your thing. But so NU Mobile is the name of the new brand.
Yeah.
Apparently they've already launched it. They've done what they call a soft launch, because that's what the cool kids call these things, with their own staff, and they're about to launch it for the rest of us. Are you going to jump in line to buy an iPhone 5, mate, on a mobile contract?
So here's the funny thing, right? So they're doing this trial using the millionaires. You know, you'd expect the millionaires all have the latest app.
That was my first thought,
so,
too.
So it was a very good soft launch because nobody actually used the phones. So I don't know.
Maybe the office staff don't quite get the same deal as everybody else.
So I don't know. I think, I mean, more competition is welcome, although it's hard to see you know, this is like going to be like a low margin business because effectively, I mean, you're still using the Telstra network, yep. right? So you can pay them for network access, a fixed amount, which probably is going to be some sort of step function based on the number of users you've got in your network.
Yeah, right.
So this is good for Telstra.
There's some sort of backhanded deal, though. Because, well, not backhanded. That sounds like I'm being dodgy. I figure they'll do some sort of deal because they are providing the leasing for Telstra in the first place. Yeah. So I've got to figure that between the two companies, there's some deal here where I would bet Macquarie gets reasonably nice access prices because they're also their mobile kind of handset provider, right, or their lease provider from that perspective as well.
It's quite possible. So they might be doing some better rates for those lease financing. Maybe maybe that helps grow the market for them and then provides access to other people through these devices. So it could be interesting. Again, more competition is always welcome, I think, in this sort of industry. Good for consumers.
Yes, indeed.
I don't really know yet from an investing point of view whether there's anything. It's probably going to be like a small thing to start off with. It doesn't really impact the big guys yet.
So what I love about this from Macquarie's perspective is this is, I mean, you're right, mate. This is, Macquarie aren't trying to become the number three player in the market, right? This is exactly what you would expect a smart, savvy investment bank to be doing, is kind of realizing they've got a warehouse full of phones and someone says, hey, should we throw these out? Someone's going, well, if we can make a couple of bucks a month out of this thing, then hey, we might as well, because it's money that we wouldn't get otherwise. If they can recover the cost of their marketing, then everything else is upside. They're kind of no new phones to do, no new infrastructure to provide, a bit of billing, so there's something there, and I dare say they'll outsource that as well, just quietly. So effectively, all they're doing is trying to find a second life, if you like, for the handsets they're taking back. It's not going to, you wouldn't want to start this business from scratch if you didn't already have a fleet of phones. On the flip side, I think it's kind of smart, right? It's what you want and expect a company to do is to say, well, I can throw these out or I can make a bit of extra money. I'll go and make some cash.
Yeah, and maybe they would sell those same phones maybe at the Telstra shop or at the, whoever else's shop.
I wonder if they'll do that.
Yeah, so maybe they'll do that, we help you sell the new ones.
Yeah.
And you help us sell the old ones.
There you go. So New Mobile is the name of the business. If you want to have a squiz, apparently the website's up, although not a lot of detail just yet. So keep an eye on that. If you're a betting man, mate, do you think it'll be a successful or a failure for Macquarie?
For Macquarie, I think most things are success. So Macquarie is one of those companies that I would never bet against. So
they don't lose very often, do they?
Yeah, no. I think a bunch of smart cookies out there, really well run companies. So I think it could work.
I will say that Macquarie also did back in the day have Lime taxis, which hasn't worked out particularly well for them. So not every at bat is a winner, as the baseball fans would say. But I've got to say, I think it's a smart strategy. Even if it doesn't work, it's something they should be trying, right? They should be leaving that money on the table without giving it a red hot go.
Real money advice from real people, not just a couple of dicks with a Porsche. Get more at fool.com.au/MMM.
Now, I'm going to do my best Dr. Evil impersonation here and say $1 trillion. That's the value. This is the third company to reach that mark. Am I right, Doc?
I think so.
This company, and so let's do this. If you're listening to this in the car or going for a jog or at the office or somewhere else, have a think about which company you think might have just hit $1 trillion of market cap. So market cap, of course, defining our terms, is the value of the company's shares, all added together. So all the shareholders and all the shares times the share price. Now $1 trillion. We've had Apple and Amazon. I reckon if most people are thinking, maybe it's Facebook or Netflix or Google, but it's none of these, Doc. Not one of the fangs.
It's not one of the fangs.
It's something else, and it's
the company that nobody, would have thought
and
would
get there. It's kind of the granddaddy of the tech group these days, right? I mean, I guess IBM you could put before them, but other than that, this is kind of the...
Yeah, well, I mean, it's the same time. Actually, the founding is probably a year or two before or after. I can't exactly remember Apple.
Okay, so that's enough. Give people some clues. All right, mate. Unveil the name. Who or which company?
That's a small company.
$1 trillion business.
It's a small company called Microsoft.
Microsoft.
Yeah.
This was yesterday's hero, right? This was the king of the Office software suite and the email that kind of got bypassed by everybody else. It wasn't very cool and sexy anymore. It was on a downtrend. Who uses Microsoft Word anymore? Who uses Windows anymore? It turns out Microsoft have managed to put themselves into a $1 trillion, very, very rarefied category.
Yeah.
How have they gone about earning so much money, or in market cap terms? Anyway, how have they justified to the market they're worth $1 trillion?
Yeah. So I think one of the things that Microsoft has done very well is, Microsoft missed a number of boats, right? So they missed the search boat. They have a decent share.
You are the only person, sorry, that uses Bing, I believe.
I use Bing largely because I love my privacy, so I refuse to use stuff from Google as much as I can, and I don't use Facebook.
Right.
And I hate Facebook with a, and I'm not making any comments on their on the investing merits here, but I just don't use Facebook.
Fair enough. Okay. That's pretty clear.
Yeah, pretty clear. But when Microsoft, it's an interesting company. They missed all these things. They missed,
so they're not worth $1 trillion because of search. They're not worth $1 trillion because of the browser.
In fact, they have actually, they're taking the Google Chrome browser and changed and basically repurposed it, right, to a browser now, which they're calling Chromium, basically because that's an open source project. And they worked very closely with Google to, tailor it for their needs.
Is Bing not long for this world, do you reckon, or are they going to keep?
Bing is going to be there. And they're going to use, probably repurpose the new Chrome browser, which they're going to make available on all these other, or Chromium browser on all these other platforms, right? And then maybe push Bing there.
Okay. So then it's not from browsing. Yeah. Where's the money coming from?
It's from reinvention of some of the old stuff, like the Office Suite and a little thing called Azure. Which is basically their cloud computing platform.
Now, it's all about the cloud.
It's all about the cloud.
And this is not just, sexy cloud talk, right? This is actually company delivering results. Now, there's probably some enhanced multiple because the cloud is sexy. So to be fair, market cap-wise, there's probably an extra bit of value there because they're doing something in the cloud. And we know that acronym SAAS is always a nice thing to be able to attach to your business. But they're actually delivering really, really strong results.
Yeah. So I think their cloud results. So when they say cloud, they basically mean the Amazon Web Services equivalent, which is basically Microsoft Azure, plus everything else that they now have on the cloud, which is their essentially the Office Suite plus Exchange and everything else.
Yeah.
Right?
Okay.
That whole thing grew something like 70%.
And this is Microsoft we're talking. This is not some little startup that's 5 years old, right? This is the 40-odd-year-old Microsoft?
40-year-old Microsoft, but okay, 70% for that segment. I think overall it was only like 10 or 15%, something like that.
Okay,
but 70% growth in that's one segment, which is, the growth segment. And they're winning customers left, right, and center, all sorts of blue chip clients coming to Microsoft Azure.
So. Now, I've been watching this for a little while. And I was flabbergasted when I first heard about how well they were doing with Azure. How does Microsoft as a business... So we talk about US companies a little bit, and we do so because A, they're interesting in their own right, but B, there's hopefully some investing and some business lessons from them. A 40-year-old kind of business, it was derided by everybody, right? It was everyone hated Microsoft. The Apple fans hated Microsoft. It was Mr. Softy. It was old. It was slow. It wasn't developing much. It was kind of yesterday's computer company. Most people, tech and investing, were kind of happy to leave that to, the old fogies and move on with the really cool new stuff.
Yeah.
How has Microsoft managed to turn its business around to go from being yesterday's hero to kind of today's hero, really to tomorrow's hero?
So I think that one of the great things here is, because as a legacy provider and provider of Exchange, so Exchange is basically this email server, right? Email service, right? And a lot of companies around the world, blue chip companies around the world, would have Exchange.
And let's just define that. So there's not a product called Microsoft Exchange that consumers will be using, like it was Gmail or something else.
Yeah.
The Exchange kind of platform underpins, when you use Outlook for work, you log into your Outlook account. We use my account's at fool.com.au. Yours is too. When we log into that, we use an Outlook, either program on our computers, or we use an online cloud-based version. And that uses what we call Exchange as the kind of the back end that runs that, right?
Database for emails.
Every large company for years, almost every large company for years, no matter what other software you used, almost everybody still uses Exchange, right?
Yeah. So that became their gateway to basically saying to people, like, look, we'll move you to the cloud. We'll move Exchange to the cloud for you. We'll move, Microsoft Online, everything, Microsoft Office Suite online to the cloud for you. And guess what? With that, we can also move your database to the cloud, and we can also provide you infrastructure services. And essentially, instead of you, being, say, a bank or a retailer or whatever, you want to run, compute infrastructure, you want to buy computing power, you want to buy storage, why do you need to go somewhere else? Come to us. Everything at one place, right?
Okay.
And I think one of the benefits for them has been that they're really not competing with anybody. They're not a retailer, right? So if you're a retailer, if you go to Amazon, it's like, giving away some of your secrets, right? What you're selling, because Amazon could decide to sell that same stuff.
Yeah, right.
I call Amazon web services the platform of choice of so the techies, like, you know, the techies and the startups, the people in the Silicon Valley have grown and have used AWS. But the blue chip companies today, a lot of them, you know, if you go to big supermarket giants they, or the banks, you know, they're actually going to Microsoft. So it's very interesting. And I think, you know, they've carved themselves. Satya Nadella, who leads this company now, has done a fabulous job of essentially, you know, streamlining what they offer. And the other thing I'll add, you know, Microsoft Surface, like their little, you know, hybrid between MacBook and the iPad.
So this is fascinating. My wife's got a Surface, full disclosure, not that I need to disclose it necessarily, but she kind of likes it. And I see plenty of them around. I am astonished. I'm blown away.
20% growth.
And these are really, really bloody expensive computers, stuff, right? Yeah. They're not, I think they're probably the most expensive, you know, kind of PC-based device you can grab, I think.
They're almost as expensive now as, you know, stuff that you buy from Apple, right?
Right. And you kind of think, well, why, you know, why are people just, at some level, like, I'm not an Apple fan, right? As a consumer, I'm happily using my Microsoft and Android products, but I like the company. Broadly speaking, you kind of think, well, if you're going to spend that much money, you might as well buy a Mac at some level. I'm surprised more people aren't making that choice at that price.
I think, you know, I think now they're providing basically for those people who want Windows and want Office products and a Windows environment,
right,
providing them an Apple-like experience. And basically, you know, that's what it is. Yep, Microsoft Surface is basically providing an Apple-like experience. So, you know, I actually really like the company. And I've said that before, you know, I might like Apple more, but I do like, you know, Microsoft. And I think what their strategy, I really like their strategy and what they've done. So again, there's something there, you know, big companies do grow, you know, at some point this was $500 billion company, it's probably doubled, right? Great dividend.
Who said elephants can't dance? The IBM book from Lou Gerstner. That is just phenomenal. I'm still a little bit, as I said, we watched it for a little while, so I'm not super surprised it's just hit a trillion. But if you asked the Scott Phillips of 5 years ago where Microsoft would be today, I would have given you really, really long odds that it was the third company to hit $1 trillion. Like, I would have put it 10th or 12th or 15th in terms of the companies I thought would get there in time, right?
Yeah, that's
just
true.
Amazing.
Get more Motley Fool money advice at fool.com.au/MMM.
Maybe we were just speaking about elephants that can't dance. Maybe the biggest elephant, and certainly the man with the elephant gun, to throw a couple of, how's that for a tangent? I'm getting good at this stuff. A couple of years, Will Porter, our producer, give me the big thumbs up, the big okay sign. He's obviously very impressed. Or it's just a very, very low bar, which is probably the case for me. Let's be really good. I'll give a thumbs up for that one. There we go. If I can clear a low bar, I'm doing well. So it's a good Friday morning. Mate, the elephant gun, of course, I'm talking about Warren Buffett. He's been in the news in the last little while. He's got it's $100 billion of cash. I think it is over $100 billion of cash that's sitting around gathering relative dust or virtual dust while he tries to find something to buy. Now, that was its own problem. Company still doesn't pay a dividend. He's out today saying that you might as well buy shares of the S&P 500 as buy the shares of Berkshire. In other words, he doesn't expect Berkshire anymore to outperform the S&P 500 by any reasonable amount. Is this Buffett kind of giving up on the whole thing and walking away?
I don't know. I mean, over the last, 10 years, I think, 10 or 15 years, Berkshire hasn't actually beaten...
10 years, I think, yep.
Yeah, hasn't beaten the S&P by a significant margin.
Right. In fact, over the last 5 years, it's losing. Yeah, losing, I don't know about 10, but 5, certainly.
So, I don't know. I mean...
Actually, before I let you keep going, I'm going to jump in only to say I own Berkshire Hathaway shares, which regular listeners will know.
Yeah.
But as we go into the rest of this conversation, I want people to be aware up front of my personal subconscious and conscious biases. I'll try and put them to the side, but just for reference.
I don't know. I think Berkshire's main issue might be that... I think Berkshire's big value creation has come from the businesses that they have acquired and that they have folded into the Berkshire fold, and that basically are the independent, you know, the Geico's and... all the other things that they have actually,
almost,
the See's Candies and things like that, right?
And energy generators, it owns railway companies, owns a whole lot of stuff. Paint manufacturers, the Oriental Trading Company, which does about everything.
Don't they even have any screws and
precision cast parts?
Precision cast parts.
Iskar is a machine tools business out of Israel.
Right. So all sorts of things. And I think a lot of value creation has come from there. But I think one of the things I'll note is that Berkshire has tended to buy businesses that are very, tend to be capital heavy.
Yep.
And I think those businesses are not likely to return high you know, at least that's what I think, high returns going forward. A lot of the S&P is now getting dominated by these, you know, capital light businesses. Mm. That's probably part of the equation here. The other thing is that, I mean, it's pretty big already, right? I mean, something that's big and that is capital heavy is very difficult to grow fast.
Yep.
I think maybe that's part of it. Maybe something else is brewing. I don't know what it is. frankly, he can just pay a dividend, right? Or he could just, you know, do some share repurchases.
Which they are doing a little bit of, but I think to your point, at some point, they can definitely ramp that up.
And I think the other problem maybe is that you've got $100 billion in cash and you don't really, I mean, for them to buy something, I don't need to buy the full thing. There aren't many that they could buy, or they need to buy a meaningful chunk. If they need to buy a meaningful chunk, it has to be a big company, and those big companies don't really grow that fast, right? I mean, you know. So, and I think the other thing is that he's shied away from tech, right? So, you know, his only tech investments have been IBM and I think Apple, which are not really... I mean, IBM was more of a tech play and Apple is more of a consumer discretionary play.
Yeah, IBM was more actually a services play. He kind of bought that for the services business. He bought Apple for the consumer business.
So I think maybe that's the problem, right? He has to buy things like Apple to deploy his cash, which makes it hard for him to say that you're going to do any better than... Yeah, maybe he's just being honest.
Yeah. I think that's exactly right. I've got two thoughts here. I think firstly he's being humble. I think he would hope and expect he can do better than what he's saying. I think he's an under promise over deliver kind of guy. That being said, as you've rightly pointed out, the last 5 years have been pretty lean times for Berkshire Hathaway, at least versus the S&P. I think Berkshire's done very well, don't get me wrong, but relative to the S&P is certainly lagging. So let me throw this at you, mate. The last time people had this conversation about Warren Buffett was 1997, 1998, when Buffett was badly losing to the market. Mm-hmm. And the famous headline in, I think it was the Wall Street Journal or Barron's or Fortune, was, "What's wrong, Warren?" The sense that he was being bypassed by, guess what, the tech titans and the new breed and the new business models and all that kind of good stuff that was happening around the time. Of course, in the fullness of time, I don't think NASDAQ still has recovered those highs of early 1999-2000. Is there a chance that just maybe this is another one of those cycles where tech is being overvalued, overappreciated, and as a result, both the money is not going to Berkshire instead, so it's not pushing the price up. And on the flip side, maybe Berkshire is just having one of those underperformance times while tech is in the ascendancy, and at some point, Buffett comes roaring back when tech gets revalued down again.
So I think you touched on many different themes here. So one of the things you're basically indicating maybe is this a market top?
Not necessarily. I'm more thinking about the value of tech specifically. So you mentioned the fact that, you know, I agree with you. The S&P has absolutely beaten Buffett largely because of the growth of the tech. The fangs we talked about, Microsoft, right? Add those companies together. I think if you took them out, Buffett would probably be beating the S&P. Those five, six companies have added more value than I think the rest of the market combined to the S&P 500. At some point, if the market was to say, actually, Amazon isn't worth $2,000 a share, and Apple's not worth $250 a share, and Google's not worth whatever. At some point, is it possible that the market comes back to Buffett rather than vice versa?
So I mean, everything is possible. That's number one. Number two, I think staying away from tech has been a mistake, and I think, for him, and I think I still believe, and I continue to believe that it is a mistake going forward. I also don't think tech... Many of the U.S. tech, actually, I do not think are overvalued at all. Like, I mean, you know, you're paying, 27 times earnings for Microsoft.
Yep.
So is it really overvalued? It's not really overvalued. There's a difference. Like, I mean, you know, last time in the 2000s when, you know, things were really, really expensive, you know, when Cisco was like, you know, Cisco hasn't actually, for example, Cisco as an example or Intel as an example, they have still not hit that share price. Those things were at ridiculous valuations at that time.
Right.
So I don't think tech overall is... There could be portions of tech that you know, there's a lot of the SaaS things, like, you know, so software as a service that, you know, some of these companies
are... That's worth at least 10 PE points, right? You throw SaaS in your name, you can pretty much take your PE from 7 to 27 just by adding that,
yeah,
right?
Many of these don't even have a PE, right? so many of them are selling on an enterprise value to sales multiples of like 20, 30, 40.
That sounds expensive to me.
Some of those are expensive, yes. So but there's always pockets of expense. I think there are a couple of differences here. I think it is true that NASDAQ has maybe just recently crossed what the peak was and ended out. Right? Okay. So those people who bought at that peak, you know, long 20 years, they've not made anything.
Man,
so,
brutal.
So that's, but yeah, at the same time, I think...
I think we had this discussion on the back. I think the main thing to keep in mind is a lot of things have changed. And I think the biggest change has been the ubiquity of the internet mm-hmm. and the ubiquity of mobile. And that has really changed how business is done. And has shifted the power of balance to, you know, so there was a fake tech head in the 2000s. And now I think the tech, most of the tech stuff is actually delivering real value. They actually have earnings. You know, this is not like, you know, getyourdogfood.com where, you know, you're promised to get your dog food in 5 years from now some service, right? So a lot of these things are happening. There's like a lot of earnings growth happening. There's a lot of value creation being done. So, I think I don't think... It's as if anything, it's an acknowledgement on his part that, you know, the type of investing he does, that's what I look at, is maybe past its prime. And his two lieutenants, they basically do not invest like him. So they, you know, they invest in all sorts of other businesses, new age businesses and so on. So I think, maybe it's just an acknowledgement, and maybe he's getting ready to hand over the reins of his money to Todd and whatever.
Todd and Ted. Todd Combs and Ted Wishley.
Yes, maybe to them. And, you know, maybe he's looking to retire soon.
I will say, mate, when anyone says Warren Buffett's lost it or maybe he's past his prime, that's normally a contrarian indicator that Buffett's about to do well and the rest of the market may be about to fall. That was certainly the experience in 1998, 1999. So we'll see what happens next. I tend to think you're partly right. I don't have as much faith in you on the valuations of the companies that are trading for this really, really high price. I think that's, I'm still worried about, frankly, about what that might do with and to us. Whether or not we get out of that one alive is an open question. I do think, though, to your point, what I think, I wouldn't say Buffett's missed stuff. I think it would be arrogant of me to try and say that. Buffett's invested for 50 something years way better than I could ever do. So I'm not ready to write him off just yet. What I think, though, is interesting about the change is that we see in the dot-com days, we saw tech as a separate thing. Right. And tech is, and you know this, I'm not telling you what you don't know, but just for our listeners, tech is now part of almost everything. Yep. And so it's gone from being an industry in itself, to some degree, talking about the tech sector, I think is actually a little bit misleading by most people. Now, there are some purely tech companies that are software companies deliberately. They provide software, they are genuine tech. Is Amazon tech? I think it's probably retail. And so if you think about that, the dollars going out of Walmart and Kroger and Coles in the US, or, you know, pick your preferred provider here, you know, Woolworths, Harvey Norman, whatever here, to some degree, they're going to an Amazon, right, in a new world. So Amazon, yes, it's tech powered. So in really important ways, it is tech. But in other ways, you think about what's happening here. This is not, as you said, businesses with great tech dreams with dot-com names that can all of a sudden be sold for a fortune. This is just, Amazon is a retailer doing business a different way. And so when you think about it that way, that's the thing that I think if Buffett is missing something, it's that. If he likes retail companies, great. He should be liking Amazon, at least conceptually. The price we can argue about, but I'm an Amazon shareholder too, for the record. There's some sense that if retail is retail, then just because it's being done a different way, that's something Buffett needs to adapt to over time, I think. And that's probably my biggest concern is that I think, you know, he doesn't have to necessarily invest in software companies, in programming businesses, in businesses that sell software, he doesn't understand it. But to the extent that tech is taking money away from traditional retail, for example, if you're only investing in old school retailers or old school music and video distribution businesses, for example, like a Netflix, you know, just something.
Or newspapers.
Right. So at some level, that's exactly right. Yeah, newspaper. Yeah. I mean, is Fairfax a tech company or Nine now? Yeah, kind of arguably it is, right? Because most of what it's doing is being done online, or at least the growth businesses are online. If you're going to avoid tech altogether, you've got to be careful about what you're investing in isn't being disrupted by tech, or at least what you're investing in needs to adopt that tech to stay relevant. I think if there's a change there, I'm not so sure that tech in and of itself is the only way to invest in the future, but I think what you need to be careful of is you're not investing in the businesses that aren't embracing tech and have a somewhat limited or risky shelf life as a result.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And I think the thing I would say is that Amazon, for example, he has not invested in Amazon, right? In spite of being quite friendly, I think, with Bezos.
Yeah, a big fan.
But the funny thing is that, you know, I wouldn't even call Amazon a retailer. I would just basically call Amazon a conglomerate in some sense, right? It's, you know, it's got Amazon Web Services, it's got retail, it's got, you know, streaming, it's got music, it's got, you know, Prime membership, right? So, yeah, so I think you're right to say that, you know, tech is everywhere, and, you know, avoiding businesses that look tech heavy but serve the general population in some way or the other, or general services, provide general services, essentially is basically meaning that you've reduced the investment slate to a significantly small portion. So
yeah, I think that's right. So if you're a betting man, let me ask you a direct question: should I be selling my Berkshire shares? Do you reckon?
I don't own them. I used to own Markel, which I've sold.
Okay. So Markel often describes it as a baby Berkshire?
Yeah. I think I would. Largely, it depends on what Berkshire is doing for you in your portfolio, right? I mean, if it's, you know, it's like if you're happy to take S&P like returns with maybe lower volatility, then maybe Berkshire is right for you, right? But if you're looking for growth, I mean, I don't own Berkshire largely because, you know, I have got other investments I'd call more foundational, and I'm happy to take the volatility that comes with it. But I wouldn't. I don't. And I don't tell anyone to buy Berkshire.
Sacrilege.
It's every company has a shelf life. Mm-hmm. You know, and that 50 years run is a big run for any company, right? Mm-hmm. And that too for an investment company or a conglomerate. 50 years run is huge. And it's, you know, what, $500 billion company already, right? So it's pretty big, right? So, but, you know, getting there, I mean, how much, you know, getting from there, it'll probably get to $1 trillion in maybe next 20 years. I mean, you know.
Yeah. I think you did right. I'd rather own Berkshire than S&P 500. The question for me over time is that the right decision? If tech continues to dominate and grow and Berkshire has insufficient amounts of those sort of businesses, and frankly, if other businesses aren't available at a good price, there's more than one way to skin a cat. You don't have to just invest in growth companies. You can invest in good value companies that get re-rated or that spin out heaps of cash, as you said. Right now, unless Berkshire can do that, it does really face the risk of losing to the S&P for another 5 years, right? If the tech story continues, and stocks aren't cheap enough for Buffett to buy, and in 5 years, they have $200 billion of cash in the bank. It's all nothing to buy, and the stock will continue to underperform the market.
You could just sell your Berkshire and buy in equal proportion some Apple and some Microsoft.
I knew you'd say Apple.
That would actually be good for your portfolio.
Well, the good thing is, so Berkshire owns some Apple. So there you go. Indirectly, I'm a Berkshire owned Apple shareholder. And indirectly, I'm happy that Tim Cook works for me. So there you go.
Value stocks.
Market. Stock market.
Index. Share market.
This is Motley Fool Money. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM.
Now the segment that we all love and you all hopefully love too, to been at a red faces old line. We're going to dip into the Motley Fool mailbag, Doc. And I've got a couple of questions. We've got all that much time, so we'll try and click through a couple. The first one comes from Travis. And Travis emailed us and said, "Hi, guys." This one's for Scott. He says, "Hi, guys. Insert gratuitous praise here." I can't believe people keep writing to us saying how wonderful we are. It's very nice. I'm just surprised. We've never asked them to.
No, definitely not.
Just a very nice people. We must be doing a very good job.
Yeah, we're awesome.
You'd almost think Travis felt like he had to say that to get his question asked.
I think so. Well, no.
Anyway, so he's other than that, he says, "I'm interested in Scott's statement that he isn't into mining stocks. Considering we are in Australia, tick, our top 10 exports are," and this, I quite like this list. He's redacted the actual names of the individual commodities. He said, so this is the top 10 exports, right? Number one, mining. Number two, mining. Number three, education. Number four, mining. Number five, tourism. Number six, mining. Number seven, mining. Number 8 and 9 are agriculture, and number 10 is mining. He says 6 out of the 10 are mining. Or put it another way, based on percentage terms, it's around half of our total exports. He says that's 48% from an article based on DFAT data, the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade.
Mm-hmm.
He says, "Isn't this like being in London not into financial stocks, or being in California not into tech stocks? I'd be interested to hear why he cuts so much of the market out of his consideration. Thanks, Travis." So I'm going to have a go at answering that question, Doc, and then you can jump in with your thoughts at the end. Two thoughts, Travis. I've never said I would never buy mining stocks, and I will never say never. About 2.5 years ago, I think it was, I went very, very close to recommending Evolution Mining for our members, which would have been a great winner, and I didn't do it. So I'm not claiming any false credit. I'm damning myself with a faint praise because I should have bought it and didn't. So that's my problem. So there are times when you should absolutely buy mining stocks when the fundamentals of the business and the price are really attractive, like any company on the ASX. The problem I have with mining, broadly speaking, is it's a really, really crappy business. So as a general rule, not only is it capital heavy, and you've talked about capital heavy versus capital light before, Doc, including today, not only is it capital heavy, but once you finish, if you've got a factory making widgets, right, you've got to do some repair and maintenance. Occasionally you've got to replace a machine, but that factory can, in theory, keep pumping out widgets for decades. If you're digging a hole in the ground, once you finish the hole, you've got to go find another hole to dig. So all the money, all the equipment, you can probably reuse some of the equipment if you truck it around the country and do something else with it. They do. To some degree, all that capital sunk into that hole, you can kind of only use most of it once. You buy the land, you put the effort in, you put the work in, you make some money on the way through, hopefully, if the price is kind, and then it goes away. So, you know, making money just to be able to afford to buy another hole is a really, really tough way to make money. Additionally to that, you're selling a commodity product where you're a price taker. Now, frankly, you know, the comparison with financial services and tech is great because in neither of those industries in general are you a price taker. In fact, the best businesses in finance and in software are creating products and actually being able to charge premium price. I mean, look at Apple. We talked about that plenty of times. The gross margins on Apple are fantastically wonderful compared to a miner who says, well, I guess if everyone else is paying $40 for iron ore, I got to take $40 for iron ore too. Otherwise, I can't sell a single gram, let alone a ton or two. So to some degree, if you're a price taker, you're a commodity business, very, very hard to make a decent amount of money. So that's kind of on a quality level why I'm nervous about mining stocks. More importantly, I think, actually, I'll come back to the last point. I'll round it off with that. The second thing I'll say is that just because a company or a country, sorry, has a lot of a particular thing or does a lot of a particular thing doesn't mean you should invest in it. We've just talked about tech and the NASDAQ. It would have been crazy to say in 1999, hey, I'm in California. All we do is tech stocks. I'm going to fill my portfolio with crappy overpriced tech stocks because we're in California. Or I'm in London. London's probably a great example, but maybe New York's a better one just because of the GFC. If we'd been during the GFC and said, I'm in New York. I've got to buy Lehman Brothers and I've got to buy Morgan Stanley and I've got to buy Bank of America and I've got to buy, you know, et cetera, et cetera. You get the idea. There are great times to buy great businesses. There are very few times to buy poor businesses because they're very rarely cheap enough to be worth buying. But in any case, just because you're in a space doesn't mean you should be investing. In fact, there's an argument to say that if you're in a particular country that's heavy on, say, for example, commodity exposure, well, guess what? Our overall economy is reliant on that stuff. It actually might be better off investing not in that because if unemployment spikes because, for example, China stops buying our iron ore, well, Australia may go into a recession. You don't want to be doubling up both a tough employment market, a tough business market with, by the way, my portfolio has been chopped in half because China doesn't like our iron ore anymore. So there's reasons why, ironically, you should be looking to diversify away from what we're big at rather than necessarily buying into it. The last one I'll throw at you is just that broad idea of trying to beat the market and what the best stocks are to beat the market. It doesn't matter. You don't have to buy commodity stocks just because we've got a lot of them. Our only job is to buy the stocks that are going to beat the market. It would be a huge mistake to think just because it's like people are buying investment properties, right? Plenty of people say, well, I live in, let's pick a suburb. I live in Willoughby in Sydney. I don't, but if we did, I say, well, I know Willoughby, so I'll buy another house in Willoughby. And it's like, well, you could, and yes, it's around the corner, it's tempting, but gee, do you really want both your home and your investment property in the same, you know, same suburb with the same demographic trends, the same economic trends? Wouldn't you rather have a house in South Yarra in Melbourne or in New Farm in Brisbane or in, again, pick your suburb in your favorite capital city? You want to be diversified, right? So adding stuff just because you're doing it already is not a great way to go. If you have, Travis, a particular expertise in that area because you're in that market because Australia is, you know, very high, big in commodities. So yeah, great, go for it, by all means. But no, I think it's a mistake, respectfully, to think that just because we sell a lot of something, we necessarily should invest in it. And so the reason I don't often invest in mining companies is simply because they're very rarely good quality investments. I've looked at big and small miners over a very, very long period of time. And I'll tell you what, it is very, very hard on average to make money investing in mining stocks. Now, it's just the way it is. And so, you know, I'm not avoiding them for any other reason than simply they tend to be bad investments. And there's no benefit in me being parochial or otherwise or just because we do it here. As I said, in fact, I'm actually better off saying, well, you know what? If we don't have a lot of tech in Australia, maybe I should invest in US tech, for example, or something else, because that gives me diversification and potentially growth rather than investing in bad stuff just because that's where we are. Doc, do you have any thoughts you want to add to that?
I'll just add that, you know, over time, I have experimented with lots of different miners. the good miners, the explorers, the, you know, wannabe miners.
Oh, no.
And
tell me it went well.
I actually can't remember a single case, a single instance where I've actually made money.
Yeah.
So
it's just bloody tough.
It's very, very difficult.
These things tend to eat capital. They tend to lose money or at least not make much money.
Yeah.
I'm tempted to say if you're a good trader, maybe you can make money doing that. But I don't know people who are good traders either, right? So I just don't. You've got finite capital. Your only job is to find the best possible investments you can. If I give you $10,000, go and find the best $10,000 worth of investments you can. If that's a miner, great. It's been a very, very, very long time since I considered a miner even the 10th or 20th or 30th best place for my money.
Yeah, like, I mean, you know, I've invested in BHP and Woodside and Linus.
Right.
And in none of them I made money. Again, as you said, you really need to get the cycle right.
Yeah.
You need to get the timing right? You know, if you're buying pre-product, you know, exploration stage, you need to get your timing right. You need to know that they will actually find stuff and then be able to produce it at
at a good price.
And even the highest quality mine, I think BHP and South 32, so the good and old, the old BHP kind of put back together, I think they are really, really high quality operators. I think they are fantastic business people, fantastic mining operators. They're doing the best job they can.
Rio in the mix.
But when the iron ore price is low, when it's high, by the way, they look like geniuses. And when it's low, they look like idiots.
Yep.
They're neither of those things. It's a bit like running an airline, right? Alan Joyce has done a spectacular job trying to keep Qantas out of bankruptcy. If it doesn't go bankrupt on your watch, is an airline doing well?
Yeah.
So, you know, if you're going to invest in them, invest in the quality operators. But even then, when the iron ore price, or if and when it falls from $80 to $40 and your profit goes through the floor, it's through no one's fault at all. Quite literally, it's just a commodity product. All you can do is do the best you can to try and salvage as much cash or as much profit as you can possibly find. We might talk about when we should buy miners. Maybe next week, Doc.
We'll
talk a little bit about why we would and when we would buy miners, just to round out this conversation, not for now. Maybe that's a useful conversation to have. But generally speaking, very, very hard to be a long-term investor and own the miners because they tend to, over time, well, I won't say destroy capital. It's a little bit harsh, but it's not much better than that.
Yep.
Motley Fool Money.
Mate, we've got time for one more question. This one comes from Rory. And Rory says, love the podcast, gents. Hey, hey. Thanks, Rory. Again, another person saying they love.
Great.
Surprising, mate.
We're doing an awesome job here.
We'd never ask for praise.
No, definitely not.
Humble sorts. He's love the podcast, gents. Hope you've had a good Easter break. I did, and you certainly did, as we heard.
Yes.
Would love to get your thoughts on Next DC. Big tailwinds due to the move to the cloud, but is it too expensive trading at such a high PE? Doc, you know a little bit about NextDC. Mm. Tell us in a couple of minutes, because we're not having all that much time. Tell us in a couple of minutes what NextDC does and whether or not you think it's too expensive at the current price.
Right, so NextDC is basically a data center operator.
Okay.
So what they do is they own the buildings.
Yes.
And they own the power supply, the cooling supply, the security, the cameras, and they bring in the network and everything. And then people who want to run their own data centers and don't want to actually build it, they could actually take a space, basically a set of racks, and put their own. So if I am, let me just make up a name. If I'm IBM and I want to have a data center, I could go to NextDC and get a footprint.
So if you started up DocFlix tomorrow to compete with Netflix, I know you would never do that, but if you were, you'd say, well, the first thing I need to do is get some way of distributing my content to my potential viewers.
Yep.
I've got to host that content somewhere. I could get a whole lot of computers and whack them in the garage, or I can go to someone like NextDC and say, hey guys, you've already got the whole thing set up.
Yeah.
Can I rent a little bit of space? Can I throw some of my servers into a little corner of your warehouse? And I'll say, yep. And you'll pay them by the month to do that. And then anyone who goes to docflix.com will be redirected to a NextDC data center to get their content distributed.
So the funny thing here is that, one would think that if you're IBM and you put in all the compute and the storage and so on, right? And those things have finite shelf life, whereas NextDC stuff actually has a long shelf life, right?
Right.
So NextDC is basically like Westfield, which, it's like the shopping mall that hosts all these different people and basically charges rent. So you could, effectively, you should think of it as a REIT in some form or the other.
So I was going to say exactly that, mate. So I'm glad you mentioned that, because that was exactly going to be my challenge. I have, for the longest time, not really understood why effectively a fancy warehouse, this is a warehouse, right? It could have food. I mean, it couldn't exactly. It could have food in it. It could have anything in it, right? A warehouse.
Yeah.
It happens to have computers in it rather than pallets of food or pallets of something else. And it's trading on a tech PE, where arguably I would be like, I've always said, and I've been wrong for a long time because the share price has gone really well over the last 5 years, but I've said for the longest time, I don't see how this is not just trading at about book value-ish, like a Westfield Wood or a Stockland property or a Mervac or a GPT. Mm. Why should I pay more in PE terms for someone who houses computers rather than someone who houses pallets of dog food?
Yeah, so it's the REIT for computers. I think the maybe should be trading at some sort of yield sort of thing, but it's not really.
So,
yeah,
you?
But it's not a yield play. I think largely a couple of things. One thing is that you really need to. Australia being a small country, therefore it means that, if somebody wants to build a data center, he's likely to be the big guys and none of the small guys, right?
Okay.
Which gives
because the market's not big enough to justify the cost?
Exactly.
The
market's not big enough to justify the cost. So therefore somebody who is being, it is the holding company who is willing to, do the job and then basically, sell out small parcels. So there's a little bit of that, I don't know, maybe some sort of arbitrage there that, if I am Oracle, if I'm IBM, instead of investing directly in buying land space or
kind of this is a fancy version of like a Servcorp or a WeWork, the idea of kind of you're kind of getting a serviced office kind of, so rather than feel like a proper pure warehouse, you're kind of doing something more akin to, so you're not the landlord of a big building, you're subleasing the space a little bit like a Servcorp or a WeWork.
Yeah, and it's more specialized in the sense that, you know, you still need to make sure that you have got enough, you know, network capacity, enough cooling capacity.
Right.
You need to be able to expand those cooling in, you know, capacity, and, you know, your capacity to put more stuff and your capacity to cool them over time.
So a specialized WeWork is what I'm getting.
It's a specialized sort of thing.
Okay.
Yeah, specialized Servcorp, let's call it. I think I like that analogy. So, yeah, I mean, the multiple is rich. There has been, I think, part of the reason the stock has done well, I think, is that because of this move to cloud trend, there has been a huge demand for cloud infrastructure in Australia.
Okay.
And there was nobody fulfilling that need.
Okay.
So they became effectively the only pan-Australia service provider. Right? There are other providers like Equinix and so on who are located in, and Equinix is the big boy in this business. And they have presence in Sydney and Melbourne, but, you know, these guys have actually presence in almost all Australian capital cities.
Okay.
So it's a little bit, they have a little bit of a local moat in that sense, right? They're the only ones that can provide you access to facilities across these different places.
And if you want something in every capital city, you can do some with one and some with the other, but you're probably going to get next to, so do me a national deal, put me in Perth and Adelaide and Brisbane and Melbourne and Sydney, I'll pay you X dollars and I'll get the lot in one go.
Yeah, so I think, they've nicely written, so there's a little bit of maybe enthusiasm in the share price, but I mean, that they've nicely written this trend. Currently, I think, I would say the shares are, I would say, roughly fairly valued. So, you know, it's not a screaming bargain or anything, you know, it's at what, $6 something. And a lot of that growth has happened in the form of, you know, this wave of installments happening. Okay. So there's that. So
is the biggest risk to NextDC then the fact that someone eventually with either deep enough pockets or a large enough customer base is able to compete on those bases, i.e. a national provider with sufficient kind of ability and specialization? I mean, at some point, I'm figuring that the point that someone else can put another data center in the rough same proximity in as many places, margins should fall through the floor at some point, right?
Absolutely.
Potential. So how likely is that? Are we talking about, is NextDC great until it's terrible, until someone turns up? Do you think this is sustainable? How would you think about kind of the future-proofness, which isn't a word, of NextDC? And nothing's future-proof, but how likely is it that this is a business model that's sustainable in the current form for 5 years? Or is it a case of, as soon as you feel like someone's coming down the pike, you better get out?
Yeah, so this is one something I keep repeating. You know, a lot of the tech or tech-like investments in on the ASX are what I call like niche opportunities.
Yep.
So in that sense, NextDC has this niche. It is the leader in Australia with, this footprint, with the ability to serve all its, you know, customers, right?
Right.
Given that all those customers are there, somebody else has to now be willing to, for this small market, which is big enough for NextDC, but probably not a dial mover for somebody like Equinix, to actually be willing to step up and invest capital and then try to steal all the clients that they have already hooked up, right?
Right.
Who probably are on some contracts of a couple of years. So this is one of the things where if you're the first mover in a niche market, you know, then nobody really is going to, you know, I mean, unless if Equinix wants to do it, instead of spending its own capital, it's better off probably just buying NextDC. And maybe
except that it's trading at such a high multiple of book value, other than the customer chase, ironically, the more expensive the shares are, the less likely it is to buy, because the cost of setting up a competitor is roughly kind of asset value rather than share value. Right?
Yeah, but unless if you are Equinix and you basically, and there are a couple of others like Digital Realty and so on, but if you're Equinix and you want to basically control and dominate the Australian space, and you can basically pretty much charge whatever you want to if you just buy NextDC out.
That's what you're saying.
So you can jack up the price on the other guys, right?
Right.
So I think, you know, that would be the reason, you know, for doing that. But I think right now, I feel that they're fairly in a good place, largely because, again, you know, they've basically gone first, and they were ahead of the curve in terms of, you know, the cloud investments in Australia. So they made the cloud investments here right when other people wanted to make those cloud investments, right? So they were pretty much in lockstep, and the other guys were, you know, busy serving other jurisdictions. So they basically served a need. In some form, they have a moat in that sense that, you know, they're Australia-wide.
And they kind of add incremental capacity more cheaply than someone having to build an entire thing from scratch, right?
Yeah. So somebody, again, I just feel that, you know, some of those things are, you know, they're not very durable, you know, at that sense, but at a high, you know, 30,000 feet sense, but it's durable enough that, you know, maybe, you know, just given the size of the market and so on. But here's the flip side, right? When the growth is going to slow, so is their ability to also actually grow, right? So, I mean, you know, we've had this huge wave of growth happening, but if the wave of growth slows down, you know, so is the, you know, multiple is also likely going to shrink at that point, right?
All right. Buy, hold, or sell next DC at the current price?
If I own it, I'd hold it. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If you didn't own it?
If I didn't own it, I wouldn't buy it. Like, that's basically a hold, in my view. I wouldn't sell it yet. Okay. I don't think it's, you know, it's become, yeah, it's, yeah. I don't think it's, you know, I think it's got some more opportunities. I think it's, you know, good, yeah. It's a hold for me.
You heard it first from our local resident computer scientist and PhD, Anir Bhan Mahanty. Thank you, Doc.
That doesn't make it, that doesn't make this buy, hold, or sell any.
I'm just letting people know. I find it fascinating talking to you about tech, mate. I enjoy it very much. So thank you for sharing with us.
With all those qualifications added, you know, I feel that there's an extra burden on that hold rating. but
not intentional, sorry.
That's all good.
All right. That does wrap us up, fools. But before we go, don't forget you can and should subscribe to Triple M Motley Fool Money podcast through iTunes or your favorite Android podcast app. And if you like what we're doing, please give us a rating, give us a review on iTunes or that app. It helps other people find us and give us a bit of a warm, fuzzy feeling as well, because, you know, we don't really solicit positive feedback in this podcast. We're very much just...
We're very humble.
We're men of the people. Yeah. We're men of the people. And if you like what we're doing, please also subscribe at www.fool.com.au/...
Triple M.
That's it for this week's Motley Fool Money. We'll be back next week with another dose of foolish insight. Fool on.
Fool on.
The Motley Fool and people appearing in this program may have positions in the companies mentioned. General advice only. Please speak to your financial professional to understand how it may pertain to your situation. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/triple M. The Motley Fool operates under Financial Services License 400691.